I wanted to speak with you this evening about what I call the mysterious minhag of gebrachts. Now, the obvious caveat, if not irony, is that I am speaking at a program which made sure to advertise on every flyer that this is a non-gebrachts hotel, which is, I'm guessing, a large part of the reason that we're all here. However, nevertheless, it is an important topic to understand, even if it's not your personal minhag, because number one is, it is a bona fide minhag, as we'll speak about, so we should understand all of Jewish traditions. Number two, I think it was either this year or last year in the OU's publication, Jewish Action, they mentioned just as a commercial reality, at least in the States, the number of people keeping gebrachts is increasing, which they see in the market of the different companies making alternate different, whether it's potato flour or the like, but they see this in terms of their hashkacha, that the number of products for non-gebrachts is increasing. So if it's a growing minhag, we should certainly be aware of it. And in fact, what I'd like to show is that if one understands the minhag, even for those of us who do not have that personal minhag, it'll give us an appreciation not only for a perspective on confronting and dealing with the chametz challenges that can exist, but I think also if one will just take a little bit of a global view, it'll give a greater appreciation, even as an example of the larger phenomena of minhagim and the tenacious dedication that those who have particular minhagim hold on to them. And on that point, I want to begin with a true story. A true story that created a shaila, which I want to address indirectly through this year. And it's a story that is contained in the well-known and powerful work of halacha known as the Tshuvas Mimamakim, written by Rav Ephraim Ushri, Zatzal, didn't pass away that long ago, who was the Rav in the Kovna Ghetto. The most famous Rav of the Kovna Ghetto was Rav Avram Shapiro, known as the Kovna Rav, the Dvar Avram. But when he was already older and infirm, so the younger Rav Ushri was already active, and then he officially took over after the Dvar Avram, Rav Avram Shapiro, died. So Rav Ushri, who Baruch Hashem survived the Holocaust, he was asked shailas not only before, during, and after unimaginable questions that related to the hellish circumstances that the European Jewry found themselves in, and he collected it in a multi-volume work known as Tshuvas Mimamakim, Questions from the Depths. So in Chelek Hei Simen Vav, he tells the following story and question. Apparently, Pesach 1942, the Kovna Ghetto was still intact at the time, it had not been liquidated. There were a few dedicated Jews who felt that despite, or perhaps because of, the circumstances that they were confronted, they wanted to do whatever they could to see if they could get some matzah. Now, you know, the average caloric intake of Jews in the various ghettos was barely 1,000. The number of Jews that died in ghettos is astronomical, just from starvation, from disease. They had nothing. The thought of somehow getting matzah, almost impossible. But there are two things you need to make matzah. You need an oven, that's kosher l'Pesach, and you need the right flour. And by hook or by crook, and I mean that, I guess, somewhat literally, they were able to get access to an oven which they were able to kosher. But now they needed the flour. There was no flour in the ghetto. Certainly not that they could use for matzahs. One of the men who was part of this chabura was named Moshe Goldkorn. And he was one of those lucky individuals who had one of these, I guess we might call it a work visa, or whatever the more precise term was. He had permission to leave the ghetto during daylight hours because he worked at a factory that the Nazis needed outside in Greater Kovna. Now, of course, he was not allowed to bring anything with him, certainly not allowed to bring anything from out of the ghetto inside. However, at great personal sacrifice, he volunteered, given his access, to be the smuggler. He had a hidden compartment, a lining in his jacket, and he would smuggle out each day some item, which he would then use to barter with some of his non-Jewish co-workers or people that he had access to for flour. And sure enough, Rav Ashri attests, in a 10-day period close to Pesach, they were able to bake enough matzah that there was a kazayas for about 100 people. Astounding accomplishment. Just a few days before Pesach, however, this same Moshe Goldkorn, who was trying every day to bring in more flour and more flour, he got caught. He got caught at the gate entering the ghetto. He was frisked and they uncovered the flour. Ashri describes how Moshe Goldkorn was beaten to a pulp. And in particular, after they beat him in every other way, a rifle butt was taken and smashed in his mouth. Broke his teeth. Now imagine the scene. This tzaddik, who was willing to risk his life for the sake of the mitzvah, and now, just a few days before Pesach, he has no teeth. He's barely alive, bloodied, bruised. He had a question. Now, if that would be me, I would also have a question. But that wasn't his question. As he comes to the Kavna Rav, he comes to Rav Ashri, and he says, I was so happy, so excited to have a little piece in this mitzvah to be mezakeh, the rabbim, to help other people fill this mitzvah. I was so looking forward to being able to have my kezias. But what am I going to do? I have no teeth. How am I going to chew the matzah? There's no way. And if you'll say I should soak the matzah shruya, says Moshe Goldkorn, I'm from Dorei Doros of Hasidim. We don't eat matzah shruya. We don't eat gebraktz. What should I do? Is it permissible, Rav Ashri, for me, Hasidus Shaman, to have gebraktz in these circumstances? This was the Shaila. You just have to pause for a minute just to say, Mi ka'amcha Yisrael, to ask such a Shaila. But this is a Shaila. So, what is it all about? So the first thing we need to understand is that it is unquestionable that gebraktz presents no halachic problem of chametz. I say that not only as someone who eats gebraktz. I say that because as someone who will quote shortly the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, who is perhaps maybe the most famous proponent of the minhag, he says it in the first line of his tshuva. There is no halachic problem for real. No chametz shaila. How do we know this? Two Gemaras seem to be explicit on that point. Number one, the Gemara Masechet Pesachim on Daf Lamed Tes says the following: Elu Devarim She'ein Ba'in Lidei Chimutz. There are certain things which cannot become chametz. And the Gemara continues and says: Ha'afui Hamavushal V'Chalut Shechaltu Barotchen. And the Gemara, a line or two later, explains what does the Gemara mean. Ha'afui, something that was already baked as matzah, which you then are mevashel. You then mixed it with water. Even it could be very hot water, even boiling water. Says the Gemara, it cannot be, by definition, axiomatically. It cannot become chametz. Ha'afui, once it's matzah, it can't be chametz. How do we get it to matzah? That's a different topic, a different shir. But for our purposes, without getting too complex, too fancy, you got it into the oven less than 18 minutes, it's matzah. Once it's matzah, it cannot ever go back. It cannot become chametz. It's a beferish gemara, the Shulchan Aruch paskins this way. Number one. Number two, just a daf and a half later, in Maseches Pesachim, daf mem aleph, amud aleph, the gemara is an interesting machlokes, not in general about matzah, but specifically about Leil HaSeder. So the stakes are even higher. Matzah's mitzvah, the Torah obligation, the mitzvah d'oraisa to have matzah to Seder. So the Gemara quotes one opinion, which says, even at Leil HaSeder, Rokik Hashoroi V'mavusho, you fulfill your mitzvah. What does that mean? If you have a matzah cracker, a piece of matzah, which you either soaked, Shoroi, you soaked it in water, or even more, you were mevashel, you cooked it in water, According to the first opinion, either one of them, you can fulfill your mitzvah at the Seder with. The second opinion says, don't go so far. It's a little too extreme. Hamavashel, once you cook it, that's no longer baked by definition. And matzah has to be baked. However, says the second opinion, I'll grant you that hasharui, just soaking matzah, as long as it's not nimuach, as long as you didn't soak it so much that it dissolves. I mean, in theory, you could soak matzah so much that it dissolves, but you could catch it in your hands or in a spoon, and you'd have the same volume of matzah, just incredibly mushy and dissolved. So that, everyone agrees, that would be too far. But take a piece of matzah, as long as it keeps its shape and its form, and you soak it, according to both opinions. In the Gemara, not only is it not chametz, you even would fulfill your mitzvah as a matzah elel haseder. And again, the Shulchan Aruch passings this way. In Siman Tov Samach Aleph, in Nechos Pesach, Siv Dalet, the Shulchan Aruch passings like this second opinion. We wouldn't cook matzah to eat at the Seder, but to soak matzah, you fulfill your mitzvah. The Mishnah Berurah adds something which is implicit in the Gemara, which is, this is not ideal, this is not preferred, this is not lechatchila, but bidi eved, for a person who couldn't otherwise be able to chew the matzah, soaking the matzah is 100% okay. Again, it's already baked. It's matzah. Soaking, it's okay. And not just okay, it's not chametz. It's okay to fulfill the mitzvah. And again, what's so striking about this Gemara in particular is the whole discussion, which again, I didn't read it to you inside. I paraphrased it. But you'll trust me for the moment that I'm paraphrasing it faithfully. The whole discussion is all about how can you fulfill your mitzvah. What was absent from the Gemara's discussion? Even a chashash, even a whimper, even the slightest shemitz, a little bit of a fear. Maybe it's chametz. That's not even in the equation. The only question is, can you even fulfill be'erev tochlu matzos? So the poskim, I say, including those who are advocates of the minhag, all acknowledge openly from these two Gemaras, other sources, unimpeachable halachic record to stand on. There's no actual chametz problem if you take something that is bona fide matzah, you soak it, you grind it up into a matzah meal and make a knedel, matzah brei, my personal favorite. It cannot become chametz, period, by definition. So, of course, the question then is, so where did the whole thing come from? This is why I call it a mysterious minhag. Where did it come from? So, if one looks in the poskim, you find two different explanations, two different reasons. And even though it's true that to ask the average person, they'll tell you this is a Hasidish versus non-Hasidish thing, and it has become to some extent that, those who were worried and kind of advocating this minhag, it started way before the Hasidim. We now know with more recent manuscripts discovered that some of the, they should forgive me, I mean this not in a chas v'shalom pejorative way, but some of the lesser known Rishonim already discuss this. Now, it didn't pick up steam until certain very prominent Hasidic Rebbes adopted it as a custom, but it's already an issue that goes back, if one knows how to look, to the medieval period. So what's the first issue which could come up? Again, we have two Gemaras that say there's no problem. So what's the... So one possibility, the first one, is mentioned, again, the earlier Achronim didn't know about this because they didn't have the manuscript. But we now have the Sefer, the Ra'avon. The Ra'avon was an 11th century Rishon from Ashkenaz, from Germany. And the Ra'avon already writes in his Chedushim and Maseches Pesachim the following. He says he's aware in Germany of a custom of people who will not soak matzah at the Seder. He specifies the Seder. He says, and people think it's because they're worried that it could bali de chimutz, maybe it'll become chametz. So says Rav, well, that's, you know, he says it in a polite way, but that's basically amaratzis, that's ignorant. The Gemara says it can't be. Once it's matzah, you can't go back. But he adds, even though that's not an issue, he does suggest, he quotes, and he seems to quote favorably, that nevertheless, one should not have what he refers to as, in Hebrew, farfel. And it seems like he doesn't just mean the Seder, but the whole Chag. Why not? His line is, in four words, Shelo yasu gam mikemach. Namely, he's worried about confusion. or what we sometimes refer to as Maris Ayin. You took matzah that was already fully baked. It's inviolable. It cannot become chametz. You ground it up into a flour-like substance, and you mixed it with water, and you cooked it. You made a knedel, you made farfel. But someone might see that and not realize that what you were grinding up and what you were kneading into your knedel, it wasn't matzah turned into flour, turned into a matzah meal. They might think it is what? It's just flour. That will become chametz. You can't do that on Pesach. And therefore, because of that concern, he says maybe it's a good idea to avoid what he referred to as farfel. Now, it's true that the Ra'avya, also a great Rishon, Ra'avya also quotes this, and he says, it's a chumra shel hevel. Don't have to be concerned for this. And that debate of should it be neurotic with the lowercase n or even neurotic with an uppercase n, everyone's neurotic on Pesach. That's normal. That's the normal of Pesach. And we're supposed to be a little bit neurotic about chametz. But should we even be neurotic with a capital N? So that seems to be a machlokas in the Ravon and the Rav Yo. Interesting. That machlokas is repeated in the more recent generation of the Achronim. If you look in the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, known as the Shari Tshuva, it's a long, long, long piece, where he quotes a number of, not as early as the medieval authorities, but a number of earlier poskim, Knesset HaGdola, the Marshadam, and others, who were in fact very worried. In fact, there was a particular story of a particular woman. Thankfully, they left her name out, or she'd be known, you know, she'd be in English. Not only would she never have gotten a shidduch, or else her granddaughter wouldn't have gotten a shidduch. But they don't mention her name, but they tell about a certain Oso Isha, who was an Isha Pshuta. She was a simple woman, she wasn't so learned. And she saw a very hush of a woman, maybe it was the Rebbetzin or someone else, and she saw that other more learned woman, more pious woman, making Knedlach. And she actually thought, oh, apparently if the Rebbetzin is doing it, apparently you're allowed to make flour, you know, I got it into the, you know, the pot before 18 minutes. And it was a huge mistake, and she ended up eating chametz. So the Shari Tshuva quotes Poskin, they say, you know, it's not just a hypothetical fear. In real life, in the kitchen is messy, accidents happen, you have to be careful. So that's one approach. However, the Pri Chadash, a great, great posek, also in the back of the Shulchan Aruch, the Pri Chadash quotes this, and he's furious. He says, where do you get off a few hundred years ago, all of a sudden making up new takanos? He says, Ein anu gozrin gzeres me'atzmenu. We don't make up our own chumras. It's not in the Gemara, it's not in any of the earlier authorities. Again, they didn't know about the Ravon. But I have a feeling he wouldn't have been impressed even if he did know. He says, what kind of business is this to be so neurotic? He says, it doesn't make any sense. And you'll tell me there was once a woman. Well, because one Nebuch woman, again, he's not making light of this particular woman, Nebuch, who had chametz by accident. Because of one story, the whole Jewish people has to have what he refers to as no simchas yamtif. Now, that resonates with me. I mean, Pesach without matzah brai is just... I have to be honest, I could go with a week without matzah balls. I could survive. But a whole year I look forward to the matzah brai, 1 week. So, if you really are worried about, you know, gebracht, it's okay. But says the Pri Chadash, because somebody might make a mistake. So that exact tension is exacerbated, and repeated, I should say, in a later generation. I'll add one more point on this particular issue, and that is that there was a great and very creative and innovative thinker, a great Rav and a Posek, also a commentary, Shulchan Aruch Nezer, Shlomo Kluger. Kishmo Kein Hu, he was a Kluger mensch. Very, very sharp, very innovative. So sharp that, you know, you could get yourself in trouble if you're too smart. And he sometimes did. He has shitos, which are often out of left field, or right field as the case may be, but not always so mainstream, but very, very brilliant thinker, very brilliant Posek. So Shlomo Kluger, he also suggests, maybe this is a genuine bona fide concern. People will be confused. It's tricky. And he says, well, to this claim that how are we to make up our own, you know, gzeros and minhagim and neuroses, he thinks that maybe it goes back to a Gemara. Really? A Gemara? I thought we said there's two Gemaras that say Beferish, there's no problem. So he's such a genius. He discovered what he thinks is a source even in the Gemara. What's the issue? So it's very, very complex. It's actually two Gemaras, but I'll try to simplify it for you, but still keep the flavor of the issue. There's one Gemara that speaks about something called Kimcha D'Avishna. Now, avishna means dried or parched. Kimcha usually means flour. So some kind of a parched kimcha to avishna. And the Gemara says about that case, you shouldn't use it on Pesach. Why? Meaning you shouldn't cook with it. Why should you not take this parched item and mix it with water and cook it? Maybe you think you parched it 100%. Maybe you didn't. Maybe it was not yabesh kulehai. It was not mevushal, if you will, to borrow a term called sarcho from Hilchos Shabbos. That's one Gemara. There's a second Gemara, however, right next to it, an amud later, which speaks about a different phrase called chasisi. And the Gemara there says that you are allowed to use and cook on Pesach. And the Gemara then says, sounds like we're dealing with something, if not identical, but similar, and I'll get to that in a minute. The Gemara then has two comments, a Lishna Kama and a Lishna Basra, both from Rava. One version of it has the great sage Rava saying, really? You're going to allow people to cook with this thing called chasisi? The story was that the Reish Galusa, the exilarch, who was very powerful and wealthy and had lots of servants, kind of like being in a hotel for Pesach perhaps, everyone's waiting on him hand or foot and cooking and cleaning for him. So the Rava says, according to the first version, how could you allow them to cook with this chasisi in the house of the Reish Galusa? There are so many avadim, so much hired help there. They're probably not the most learned group, the hired help, the staff. And it's inevitable that it's going to make a mistake, right? If you were a mashgiach in a hotel, you would want to keep things as simple as possible. There's too many things could go wrong. So says Rav, according to the first version, how could you allow this? Something could go wrong. We don't exactly know what yet. A little bit of a mystery. But the mystery is deepened, because then the last line of the Gemara says, well, maybe there's a different version of the events, which not only did somebody say hypothetically it was mutter, that Rava himself went to the house of the Reish Galusa and he cooked with this chasisi. So now that I've given you the pieces on the board, we need to identify, what are we talking about here? At this point, if you're a little confused, that's good. You're supposed to be. So what's going on? So the Rambam says, the only way to make heads or tails of this is to assume that the Gemaras are referring to similar but different items. Because one Gemara seemed to say it was mutter, one Gemara seemed to say it's asur. Which one? So the Rambam says as follows. The first Gemara that says kimcha da'avishna is asur, because maybe you won't fully parch it before you mix it with the water, that was referring to taking actual grain. You took the wheat, and before grinding it up, before doing anything, you put it in the oven and you blasted the furnace, you blasted the oven, the heat, and you totally parched that wheat. Then you ground it up and mixed it with water. Says the Rambam, maybe the wheat wasn't as parched as you thought. Maybe there was some latent moisture. And even though you think you were very careful, because from the time you mixed the flour with the water, it was less than 18 minutes, but maybe there was already still some natural moisture in the wheat. And maybe you didn't totally parch it, and therefore the clock started before you realized, and you have chametz. The second Gemara, which allowed this thing called chasisi at the house of the exilarch, that was referring to something else, where you took wheat, you ground it into flour, and then you took a plate of flour and put the flour straight into the oven. And you blasted the heat to totally parch the flour before you ever mix that flour with water. And therefore, you could be 100% certain that when you put that flour with water, it had already been cooked. The Gemara we started with. Once it's baked, it can't become chametz. So says the Rambam, that's the solution. And in fact, this is how the Shulchan Aruch paskin. The Shulchan Aruch says, don't be so clever. Think you're going to take wheat and you're going to blast it in the oven and parch the wheat and then make flour and mix it with water. The Shulchan Aruch says not to do that. That form of gebrucks is a halachic problem. Because we're worried, again, neurotic with the lowercase n, we are worried, maybe, even though you think it was fully parched, maybe it wasn't totally dry. But if it was already made into flour, and then you put the flour in the oven, the Rambam assumes as a metzias, as a reality, that the flour, that will get fully parched. I mean, assuming you know what you're doing. I mean, I wouldn't know what I'm doing, but someone who knows what they're doing did it. You totally parch the flour, that'll get more dry than just a kernel of wheat, and therefore, that would be allowed. However, there are other Rishonim, particularly some of the Rishonim Ashkenaz, who say no. The Gemara is not talking about two different items, flour versus wheat. Rashi, among others, says it's all the same case. Well, it's all the same case, so how do you reconcile what's going on? So one possibility is to assume it's a contradiction. What happens when you have a contradiction? You can either reconcile it. The Rambam says, it's not a contradiction. Be more clever. Be more refined. You could understand what's going on. Other possibilities, you know, in life, there are all sorts of contradictions. Sometimes you got to vote. You got to choose. You just got to pick. So we paskin like the second Gemara that was permissive. Ooh. So then they ask, well, even in the second Gemara, it wasn't so clear. The Gemara says you could do this thing called chasisi. Then the Gemara said, well, Rava said, whoa, in the house of Exelor, with all the hired help and the staff, isn't there going to be some confusion? And then the Gemara says in the final line, but Rava himself may have done it. So it's a big balagan. But bottom line comes along Rav Shlaima Kluger with a chiddush. He says, I'll tell you how to make sense of all of it. Fundamentally, again, we go back to first principles. Something that's baked cannot become chametz. And these Rishonim, the Rashi and others, understood the whole thing was flour. You ever heard of someone putting in a wheat stalk in an oven? The Rambam understood it that way. They said, no, every case, both Gemaras, flour in the oven. So what's the problem? What's the issue? So the first opinion says, we understand, technically speaking, letter of the law, you can't have a problem with that. How could you have a problem with that? It's a Gemara. But we're worried, maybe people will get confused. Gemara then says the last word, that Rava himself did it. So whereas all of the other Mefarshim understood that these two variations, two versions of the Gemara are in dispute, says Reb Shlomo Kluger, no, it's not a dispute. What did we say? If you'll give it to the kitchen staff in the hotel, this, you know, you're playing with fire basically, that's a problem. Rava himself, the Gadol Hador, went into the kitchen and he put the flour in the oven. You're worried that Rava's going to get confused? Rava's going to make a mistake? It wasn't an argument whether we're worried or not. Both versions of the Gemara agree. We are worried when dealing with a common person. But if you have someone who's such a halachic expert that they're not worried that they're going to get confused, that would be allowed. So with this breathtaking and innovative, I would say even revolutionary understanding of resolving these Gemaras, says Reb Shlomo Kluger, and now I can give tuv tam vedas, I can give a good explanation and a reason for why there are these chassidim v'anshei maisa who are careful about gebrochs. They're worried maybe someone will be confused. So we said, who makes up? Don't be so neurotic. And we have no right to just make up our own fears and our own neuroses. Says Reb Shlomo Kluger, maybe it's in the Gemara itself. And maybe if in the time of the Gemara the worry was just about the avodim in the house of the exilarch, says, we are all ador shel amei haaretz. In other words, we get confused. You can't get, you're going to give a psak on the mass scale. I mean, you can only imagine nowadays, you know as well as I, you know, one kolol guy went into Chaim Kanievsky and asked him one thing. Within the hour, people all around the world are changing their whole way of life because there's one psak that was on a blog because of... We live in a world, there's no subtlety, there's no sophistication, there's no nuance, it's just mass communication. So the Shlomo Kluger didn't live in the time of the internet, but still... People get confused. We live in a world that's too, the communication is too diffuse, the knowledge base is too limited. He says maybe that's what the Hasidim were worried about. So let's take stock. Where are we? Where are we is step up to the penultimate stage of the shir. We've seen number one that from a strictly halachic perspective, if you're dealing with baked matzah that was then ground or matzah you wanted to put into your soup and the like, there cannot be any halachic problem, period. Even the biggest Hasidic Rebbes would admit to that. However, there's still a minhag to avoid it. Why? Number one reason that we've seen so far is, if one wants to be concerned, maybe people will be confused. They'll confuse matzah meal for flour, and you never know what could happen. We should be confused. That's the first reason. The second reason, which seems to have gained more popular currency, is the one that the Alter Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Shulchan Aruch Harav, mentions in his tshuva. And it's one which other poskim mention as well, not just him, he just became the most famous. But other poskim in Shulchan Aruch, the Shari Tshuva I mentioned, and the Machzitz HaShekel, others mention as well. And that is another thing, which is not that we're worried about the people, we're worried about the baking. I said that matzah, that's afui, the first source we said, ha'afui, baked matzah cannot become chametz, period, no matter how much you soak it in. But says the Shulchan Aruch Harav and other poskim, Einenu ra'os, with our eyes we see. Not that people will be confused, that's a separate issue. But that who said the ovens always work the way they're supposed to? Who said that the people who are working in the matzah factory who were kneading always kneaded all the flour so well? And therefore says the Shulchan Aruch Rav in his version, he says, I see matzahs, and on top of the matzahs I see flour. That's flour that's come into contact with water, but it clearly was never baked. That's an issue. So he says, it's not making chametz at the moment, but if I'll then put that in my soup, if I'll then mix that with my fruit juice or my oil when I'm making my matzah brai, that's kind of recatalyzes the flour. It's a problem. Other poskim say it's not so much flour on top, but they say sometimes you crack open, there was a little air pocket, or the thicker matzahs. They say maybe it really wasn't kneaded as well as it should have. And maybe there was some leftover flour, which if you'll then mix with water and the like on Pesach, maybe that could be a problem. And this turns out to be the concern that the Hasidim, again, Chabad in particular, but not just Chabad, took and they ran with. And you will find, again, Hasidim in general and Chabad in particular, you will not find anyone more machmir about anything else than as they are as machmir about this. There are families I know, wonderful families, they will not have anything on the table when the matzah is on the table, or if they're a little shtickle more makel, they'll cover the matzah when something else is on the table, or they'll cover something else. People very, very strict. What's the concern? So, in more recent generations, the concern seemed to be more of a focus on this, the unbaked, the not fully completed flour, somehow getting reconnected with some liquid when you put it in your soup, or you make your matzah ball, or your matzah brai, and that becoming a problem. One of the, who always argued with the Shulchan Aruch HaRav? Who always argued with the Lubavitcher Rebbe? The Vilna Gaon. So this was no different. And you could argue, and I don't know if you could prove it, but I wouldn't consider it heretical if one was had a suspicion that this became a part of a larger issue. The Vilna Gaon, not only did he say that he wasn't concerned, the Vilna Gaon went out of his way to eat Kneidlach to show that he had no concern. They tell over a story, who was the Vilna Gaon's prime disciple? Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Reb Chaim Volozhiner, when this whole tumult was happening, he made a pilgrimage to visit. Anyway, it's a din, you should see a Rebbe on Yontif. He went to see the Vilna Gaon on Pesach to ask the Shaila. But the story goes that the Vilna Gaon knew why Reb Chaim was coming. So before he could even ask him the question, he comes out and serves the soup with the Kneidlach and eats it right in front of him. No question needs to be asked under such circumstances. They say, the closest Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer and their tshuvas, the Chassam Sofer also ate Kneidlach, ate Farfel, was not makbid on Gebrachts. And yet, as I said, other poskim, and in particular Chassidish poskim, took this as a very, very serious concern. In fact, it is mentioned in the Mishnah Berurah. Mishnah Berurah says, Simin Tof Nun Ches, Sifkat and Dalid, that our Anshe Maisa, he doesn't refer to the word Chassidim, but Chassidim with the lowercase ches, if you will. People who are very pious and who care and are very careful about things, who avoid having any contact with any kind of a liquid and matzah. But adds the Mishnah Berurah, he paskins, again, shouldn't be a surprise at this point in the shiur, that's all fine if you want to have such a minug, he's not against the minug, but says the Mishnah Berurah, letter of the law, Mikra Adin, no need whatsoever. There cannot be a problem. We don't have to be worried about this. He adds, interestingly, I'm not an expert on the history of matzah making machines, but matzah making process, says Mishnah Berurah, in those days, and he's not referring to that much earlier than him, the Shulchan Aruch Rav says they had thicker matzah where there was more of a concern for the leftover unbaked flour. He says our matzah is thinner, which is, I guess, an advertisement for the thinner matzahs. And he says, we don't have to worry about it anymore. Mikra Din, there is no problem. And a caveat on this point before we move to the final part of the shiur. So there's a sefer that I didn't see quoted. I didn't see it in its original form, but I saw quoted in an article of like the practices and the stories of the Chafetz Chaim. That someone went to the Chafetz Chaim and they saw that he would not eat gebrachs. Now the Chafetz Chaim was not a chassid, and the Chafetz Chaim wrote in the Mishnah Berurah that you don't have to be careful about this. You don't have to be strict. Yet the Chafetz Chaim didn't eat gebrachs. So they asked him, "How come you're doing it? After all, the Rebbe, the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, he said you could eat it, and we know he ate it." So I assumed that this conversation was happening in Yiddish, maybe it was Russian, but the article that I read was in Hebrew, and I assuming it's a translation, I don't know if it's word for word, but the quote in the article was that the Chofetz Chaim responded to the person who asked him, his interlocutor, "Mi yitein li mi mitzvosav shel agra v'ochel gam ani shruya." As if I was as firm as the Graf, I had as many mitzvahs as the Vilna Gaon, I could take a gamble, I could take a flyer on a matzah ball. Now that's not exactly a halachic argument by strict standards, and I can't tell you that I know for sure that it's even accurate. But it's in a book, which was then quoted in an article and now disseminated to you. So they say that the Chofetz Chaim himself personally maybe didn't eat it. They say the Chasam Sofer did eat it, the Vilna Gaon did eat it. Different tzaddikim do different things, and as I say, the rabbis certainly try to avoid it. So let's end with, we have a few more minutes, let's end with a few of the, I would say, potpourri of gebrachs, starting with the Holocaust question we began with. Now, other than of Ushri's particular tshuva, which we began with from the Kovna Ghetto, of the chassid who had his teeth broken, etc., who wanted to eat the matzah, so that's a, we hope, a once in a millennia shaila. But you do have this question come up much more commonly. When is that? Not chas v'shalom in that case. When you have an intermarriage. Chassidim and misnagdim. And it's been my experience that once a chassid tastes one matzah ball, he's never going back. So it comes up in many tshuva svarim, the shaila, what if a person who grew up in a chassidish home, in particular the question to be fully, full disclosure, more often comes up with a chassidish woman marrying a misnagdish man, typically a woman's going to accept the minhagim of her husband, so she always ate. He always eats gebraks. She's chassidish at home. What can she do? So, in fact, if you strip away the drama, it's the same shaila, on some level, as we saw from the Holocaust. So, in fact, Rav Avadya Yosef has a tshuva. Rav Avadya Yosef has a very interesting psak. Before I tell you his psak, so what was the kavanah of? What did Rav Ushri say in the Tshuvas Mi'amakim? He tells the chassidish yid, which again it should be no surprise to us by now, that there's no problem 100%. For the Seder, even for Matzah's Mitzvah, you can eat Matzah Shruya. You're allowed to soak the Matzah in water to make it soft, that you could eat it, Nebuch, you had your teeth broken by the Nazi's gun. But, Rav Ushri added, he thinks you should do Hataras Nadarim. Generally, if a person accepts a Minhag Tov, so if he wants to change it and reverse the Minhag, he's supposed to do Hataras Nadarim. So he tells this Chassid Shiyid, get three men, we'll do Hataras Nadarim, and you could have your Gebrak Matzah at the Seder. Rav Avadya Yosef, as I say, in the less dramatic scenario, just of an intermarriage, so Rav Avadya Yosef has the Shaila as well. Nechav Adas, Nechelek Aleph, and Rav Avadya Yosef has a very interesting psak. He says it's important to know why we do and don't do things in Judaism. He says there are a lot of people who don't eat Gebraks, who thinks that that's really the halacha, that it's really a chametz problem. Says Rav Avadya Yosef, that is simply ignorance, it's a ta'os. And a person who finally goes to a shir, learns something, he says, oh, I realized, I can eat gebraks, I want to eat gebraks. Says Rav Avadya Yosef, even if he's been not eating gebraks for 50 years, but if it was based on a mistake, he does not eat any hataras nadarim, he can go right into his matzah ball. But, says Rav Avadya, someone's a little bit more learned, who understood Meirosh, that there's no problem with chametz for real. It's just that we want to have a hidur because we're worried about these various unlikely but possible scenarios, and therefore I know that it was my minug of a chassidus and of a hidur, but it wasn't really a halachic necessity. So that, says Rav Avadya Yosef, that's a bona fide minug. And if a person wants to switch that, then he needs to do hataras nadarim. I would have said, just ani akatan shebekatanim, that you could argue based on a different tshuva that Rav Avadya Yosef has. He speaks about a woman who always heard shofar blowing. Despite the fact that shofar blowing, technically speaking, women don't have to hear, because it's a positive time by mitzvah, mitzvah man grama. But this woman, as most of the women that we know do nowadays for sure, always heard shofar blowing. One year she had a broken leg, she couldn't get to shul. And I guess she didn't live in a community where someone's going to come to her house to blow. So she asked Rav Avadya, does she need to have hataras nadarim? That year, she's not going to hear shofar blowing. And Rav Avadya Yosef says, you only need hataras nadarim if you're going to be okay your minhag. I'm never going to hear shofar blowing again. So that a person would need to do hataras nadarim for. But just because one year, Nebuch, she had a broken leg, she's an onus, it's out of her control, he felt she wouldn't have to do hataras nadarim. So I would think maybe in this case in the Kovna Ghetto, maybe you would have said to this man, listen, Emir Tzashem, I mean, he'll never have teeth again, apparently. But maybe he won't be bloodied and bruised. Maybe they'll get him dentures. if you plan on hopefully eventually being able to then eat regular matzah, maybe this year you don't have to make ataras sedarim. That's an interesting kind of academic footnote to the shayla. But on the basic question, could this Hasidic Yid eat matzah shruya gebruchs for the Seder? Says Rav Ashri, unquestionably, yes, 100%. Let me just end, I have two more minutes or so, let me just end with one last point, which is a very interesting phenomenon, which we really have absent, since we're Zocha, to be living in Eretz Yisrael. But if one were to live in Chutz Laretz, and one were to be having an eight-day holiday, so as many of you know, there's this really curious phenomenon that even the Hasidim were so makbid not to have gebruchs the first 7 days, they go out of their way to have gebruchs and have matzah brayim k'nelach on the eighth day. Have you ever heard of such a thing? It is so peculiar. No, I mean, you've heard of this, but in any other area of halacha. So it's a very, very peculiar phenomenon. It doesn't make really any sense. So again, when you're dealing with good people and something looks like it doesn't make any sense, it just means you have to look deeper, because obviously there must be a reason. So there's two classical reasons that are given. Each one of them has a musar for us, and that's a good way to conclude this year. The first reason, perhaps the most well-known reason, both from Hasidic sources for obvious reasons, is from the Sefer called the Bnei Yisoschar, the Dinover. So the Bnei Yisoschar says, you know why the Hasidim do this? To go out of their way to show that halachically it's not a problem. If halachically it was really a bona fide concern, then of course, avada and avada, you couldn't eat it on the eighth day either. The eighth day is not chicken soup, the eighth day is also Pesach. In Chutz Laretz. Okay? But since, says the Bnei Yisoschar, we know, even in our Hasidic hearts, we know that really, really, really it's not a problem. But we have this hitter. It shows how anti-Chametz we are, how Zohir we are, how careful we are. So it says, but in order to show that we know for real, you don't have to, we go out of our way on the last day, we dafka eat it to show that the first 7 days we weren't eating them, we weren't eating the gebruchs, it was all a hitter. Fascinating idea. The last idea, which is perhaps the most beautiful, I saw in a sefer from, it's known as the Ruptschitzer Rebbe. See, he says as follows. He says, the main goal of a chag is supposed to be bring families and Jews together. What's one of the things that keeps people apart, even well-meaning people? When they have different, in America, you know, or maybe in England, you don't know exactly what this is. You come to Israel and you realize this one's beard is too long, this one's beard is not long enough. 8 different Mahadran hashkachas, the 14 different other kinds of hashkachas. People can't eat in everyone's house. They can't go out to eat at a restaurant. They can't agree which hashkacha, which not hashkacha. So it's a reality. So if you're a Hasidisha and you don't eat gebruchs, and your neighbor, who's a wonderful holy Jew, but he, you know, he's going to serve you kenedlach in the chicken soup and the kalim that they cooked, you can't go. So says the Ruptschitzer, the last day of Chag, before we say goodbye to Pesach, even the Hasidim who cling so dearly to the Chumrah of Gebruchs the whole week, they say, Laman Achdus, Laman Shalom, we're going to take down that wall, that barrier between Jews, so that at least the eighth day, despite our usual hakpados, our usual stringencies, at least for that eighth day, Jews should be able to come together, to be able to share together. A very, very beautiful idea. Whatever one's minhag is, halavai, halavai, halavai. The shalom that he spoke about, we don't have to wait for the eighth day. We could do it right away. Chag Sameach.